and welcome to The Dorothy Project. My name's Alice Beverton-Palmer. I'm a DJ at the London queer club night Push the Button, and this podcast is my space to connect with other women in the gay scene, to celebrate the impact that women have had within gay male culture, and also to think about the fascinating soup of gender and sexuality, femininity and masculinity that we all live in. Am I capable of just living my life without intellectualizing it? Signs point to no. So far, I've only interviewed other women, Dorothy's, but I was thinking it would be interesting to ask men and masculine non-binary people about the women who've had an impact on their lives and how they relate to women and femininity in all its forms. So I thought we'd kick off with the publicist Simon Jones. Simon has had an amazing career so far, shaping the public perception of gay icons from Jerry Halliwell to Jade Thirlwall. With his company Simon Jones PR, he's worked with multiple Spice Girls, All Saints, Louise Redknapp, Danny Minogue, Pussycat Dolls, Talisa, and that is naming just a few. It really is icons only. So I started off by asking Simon about the very first icons he stanned as a kid.
Well, I guess the very when you say icons, they were icons to me.
Yeah, that's what matters.
Yeah, my very first people that I stanned would have been like pop bands like Bucks Fizz and Five Star, which obviously have very strong females in them. But I guess really stanning probably was when I was about, when I turned about 12 and when I first discovered Madonna, who has kind of been probably icon of my whole life.
So what era of Madonna was
so
that?
We're talking early Madonna. So probably just as she was transitioning from the first album into Like a Virgin. So she wasn't really big here then. I don't want to be like I was on the Madonna train before everyone else, but I kind of was.
Yeah.
So she was kind of big in America and she hadn't really broken through here. And she kind of broke through probably majorly with Like a Virgin here, even though she had a few hits before that. But that was really her breakthrough UK. And I was on the train then. So, yeah, I was obsessed with her from like the beginning. But then probably the biggest moment I remember for her was when she performed Live Aid in 1985. And she came out and did Holiday and Into the Groove, and that was it. I watched that performance, I can't even tell you, over and over and over again so many times. Like I recorded it on VHS and literally...
I was going to say, how did you record that?
I recorded it on VHS tape live, and then I'd watch it over and over again and recreate the dance routine in the lounge. God knows what my mum and dad were thinking. But
What was it about Madonna? Because again, like you kind of like, yeah, obviously Madonna, but everyone's going to have a different kind of take on why she's special.
I mean, originally why I loved her was because of her songs. So I thought, you know, I loved pop music and there was something about her songs and her performance and the way that she reacted with the crowd that really, I guess, hit a chord with me. But then as my life's gone on, why I've loved her so much is the message behind her music. I mean, I come from a really tiny village in Norfolk, so I didn't really have lots of friends, not trying to be a sob story, but this is the reality of it.
Yeah.
And I used to kind of go to school and then by Friday at 4 o'clock, I'd go home and then I kind of wouldn't leave the house again until Monday morning to go back to school. So I was never one of those kids that would like go out with friends or do stuff. I would just be at home. And I guess Madonna and her lyrics and stuff kind of was what I clung to. And the fact that she was, I mean, I remember when she started speaking out about gay rights and she was talking about AIDS and things way before anyone else was, even with like the Like a Prayer album.
Yeah.
I remember buying it and it was like this kind of sticker that was, all about being supportive of people with AIDS and how you can help and stuff like that. And I remember getting that and thinking, wow, this person's so inspiring to me, even though I wasn't even 100% sure that I was gay. I mean, obviously I was, but like, you know, when you're younger, it was very different times then as well. There were no gay people where I lived, absolutely. Like it was just not talked about. The only way I knew anything about it was if there was a program on TV or if a pop mag, you know, I would be looking at Erasure or Jimmy Somerville or something like that. So when this really massive mainstream female pop star who I loved was coming out, and I felt like she was really talking to me, and I felt like her lyrics really inspired me, things like, you know, Express Yourself and even Like a Prayer and all those big songs from that time, even like Into the Groove, where it's like, only when I'm dancing can I feel this free. And it's kind of like, it's that whole thing of like escaping where you are. And I think that sort of inspired me to leave the village and kind of do other things. It was definitely her inspiration.
And who was, like, in the real world, who was around that kind of had an influence on you? Mum, sisters, or...?
I mean, I guess really only my mum and my sister. I mean, I did have some friends at school, but not... Like, I'm not in touch with any people from school now, which I think is a common thing as well. Mm. Like, I know lots of other people I've spoken to have been like, oh, I'm still in touch with my school friends, we have school reunions, and I think, oh, my God, that'd be, like, the worst nightmare for me, because I wasn't really friends with anyone at school massively. And so I could never really say that anyone at school really influenced me massively, because they're just not in my life. So they're obviously not.
Yeah.
I mean, my mum was a big influence to me because she was so supportive of me. You got to remember that coming from a tiny village, when I'm saying things like, oh, I want to, you know, record pop music, or I want to move to London, or I want to do this, it's a kind of bizarre thing where I come from.
It doesn't feel real, right?
That's not what people from my village were doing. Yeah. Like, people with village were studying and then, you know, just going into like usual jobs. They weren't talking about wanting to move to London and be involved in the music industry. And bless my mum and dad, they used to like drive me to auditions and drive me into London to do things. And my dad would take me to see Madonna at Wembley Stadium and Five Star at Wembley Arena. And so my mum and dad were really like supportive of what I did, especially my mum. She was like my biggest fan. So I guess she was a really important influence in my life. And my sister as well, she was massively into pop music. She was a massive Kylie fan. So I wasn't a Kylie fan really when I was little. I was Madonna and she was Kylie. So it was like the battle of Kylie and Madonna between me and my sister.
So has that like simmered down any stage?
Oh yeah, no, I love Kylie now, obviously. I started getting into Kylie when she was like Step Back in Time. What
right.
Do I have to do?
So you've been there for a while.
A long old time, but I wasn't in it right at the beginning. Yeah. But even because she was like from Neighbours. So it was kind of like, I was more like, oh, Madonna's more real than this. But then obviously,
yeah,
she's proved herself to be an icon before that.
Yes.
But yeah, I think that as much as my mum and my sister were there for me, I feel like, you know, more the pop icons influenced me more, for sure. Mm. They were my saving grace.
Yeah. And yeah, I guess there is, like, if you're stuck somewhere you don't necessarily want to be, I guess you can feel closer to those icons because they're everything's so far away, right? London feels psychologically really far away. So New York and the scene that Madonna was on, it's almost like mentally the same distance.
Yeah.
It's still a fantasy.
I think it's very different now to what it would have been like, what it was like, and it would have been like as if I didn't live it, what it was like then, because there was no social media, but obviously no internet and not even a mobile phone. So the only way I found out about anything was by going to the newsagent every Wednesday morning and getting Smash Hits and Number One magazine and those pop magazines that were out then. And then I had them reserved for me. I'd go to the newsagent, get them Wednesday morning, and then would read all about all the pop stars that I loved, and, you know, scouring anything about Madonna or Janet and cutting it out and putting it into scrapbooks. And like, that's how I sort of lived my life through other people, because I wasn't in touch with anyone else. Mm. I think it's probably very different nowadays, where kids can be on social media and they can be in touch with anyone in the world and share experiences and kind of socially interact in a way that I didn't interact with anybody.
Yeah.
I was absolutely just obsessed with pop stars.
Yeah.
I had no one to interact with or no friends to talk about it with, or, you know, it was just me and these abstract people I would just find out through newspapers and magazines.
And there must have been so many people who are having that parallel experience, but everyone isolated.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so how did you get to the city? Like, what was your, because so now you run your own PR agency, Simon Jones PR, but how did you get from Norfolk to here?
Well, when I was 16, I auditioned to be in a pop band, and it was part of a magazine thing. So there was two rival pop magazines, one called Smash Hits and one called Number One magazine. And Number One magazine decided that they were going to launch their own pop band. And I bought Number One magazine every week, was completely obsessed with it. And I was like, I have to be in this band. And so you had to audition for it, and it was all part of a TV series as well that was being filmed for what is now Sky One, but back then can't remember, it was called something else. And so they filmed everything. It was kind of like an early like Pop Stars.
Yeah, I was gonna say this feels very familiar.
It was before Pop Stars, obviously, but it was like that kind of thing where they filmed all the auditions, they filmed everything, and so I auditioned for the band, I got into the band. So there was like four of us, and then I obviously had to sort of half move to London at that point at 16 to be in the band. And we signed to Sony and like we released music. I mean, it didn't work. It was a complete bomb.
What was the name of the band?
They were called Number One.
Right.
Because it was like Number One, the band.
Yeah.
And we were promoted through the BBC magazines because Fast Forward was then a magazine as well. And that was part of BBC. And so we were promoted throughout the BBC magazines and obviously on the BBC shows, like the Saturday morning shows and the programme that was on Sky One. So that was kind of like a really interesting experience because it took me from being in a tiny village suddenly to being in the middle of this like world in London where I was sat in Sony Records and like, I don't know, it was like overwhelming in a way, but almost I felt like, oh no, this is what I should be doing.
Right.
Like I should be in London. Like this is what I should be. So that's kind of how I first moved to London. And then of course the whole thing went completely tits up.
And we got dropped.
Like a year.
Wow.
And so I hadn't like planned on going to college and doing my A levels or anything. I was like, I'm doing this now. And then it's a huge reality wake up call when suddenly you're completely dropped by everyone. And then you move back to like the village I was from. And then it was kind of like, everyone was like, oh, failed pop star. That's what I was then known as locally, was like, oh, he's the failed pop star. And then I had to go back to college and do my A-levels with kind of embarrassment of everyone there knowing, because it was such a small place that I'd released singles and like done this and it had all failed. And like, I had to come back and then study again. And so that was kind of tough and weird.
Yeah.
And then from there, I thought I just have to do my degree and like try another angle to get back into the business. And so I wanted to work in the entertainment industry. Yeah. I kind of thought, oh, I don't think I'm going to be successful as a pop star. Cause I was just like, I've kind of had a shot and you know, if something else came up, I'd give it a go. But I don't know, there was part of me that knew, you know, you have a gut feeling. I was just like, I just don't think that's going to work for me, but I still want to work in the industry and do something. So I went to uni in London and moved then, came back 2 years later.
Yeah. So. Wow. And then, so from uni, did you go straight into PR or?
Yeah, basically. So whilst I was at uni, I didn't know what PR was. I mean, I still think my family don't know what PR is. They're just like, oh, you work with celebrities. Simon works with celebrities.
It's like, my mum asked
that's
me,
what I do.
Do you do the tweets? And this is after me doing my job for like 3 years. And I was like, oh, no, I don't do the tweets.
I can totally relate. It's like when I first started doing PR and I'd say to my mum, like, oh, this is the cover shoot we did or whatever. My mum would be like, oh, so did you write this article? And it's like, no, I didn't write the article. I set it up. And then mum was like, what do you mean you set it up? It's like, it doesn't matter. Just I work with people. It's fine. I just look after them. It's cool. But when I was at uni, I obviously still knew a few people from the industry from being in it previously. And I was sort of reaching out to people and saying, oh, can you help me out with any work experience? And then once someone I knew was like, oh, yeah, I know a management and PR company. And they looked after lots of TV presenters. And they said, oh, do you want to come in and do some work experience? So I went in and after 3 days, they offered me a job. And so I worked there part time whilst I was at uni in my final year. So I was working in PR like in my final year of uni. Yeah. And then just never stopped from there.
So you've now got your own agency. And I think it's fair to say in your career, you kind of made a name of working with women who are gay icons. The majority of the Spice Girls, Dani Minogue, Talisa, Louise Redknapp, Little Mix. You've been on set on RuPaul's Drag Race, which I always think being a guest judge is like a good litmus test.
Yeah.
And you've had Emma, Cheryl, Jade.
Yeah.
Like, how did you end up with that list? Was it like a conscious thing that you were going to go after like a certain kind of pop culture female artist?
I mean, they are the people that I love. So obviously when you get a choice of who you want to work with, you do gravitate towards people that you are fans of or people that you feel passionately about. Mm. I mean, I could never do PR for an indie band or a rock band, or, you know, it's just not my thing. I'm not into it. And I feel like you have to be into what you sell. I mean, I do work with male artists, of course. I mean, I've worked with Ant and Dec for 21 years, like since I first sort of started in the industry, really. I've worked with them and we've had a long relationship. So I don't exclusively work with women, but you are right. When I feel like if you looked at my client list over 20 years, it's, you know, 70% women for sure. Mm. And definitely most of them are of that kind of, well, they're most of them, they've all got like huge gay fan bases.
Yeah.
I meet loads of gay guys and they're always like to me, oh my God, I can't believe the people that you've worked with, they're every single person that I liked when I grew up. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I'm the same as you though. I'm a fan. Yeah. Like, you know, why would I say no to these people if they ask me to do it? Like, I'm a huge fan of these people as well.
And like, in terms of like marketing, I find it really interesting, like marketing like female artists to the kind of gay male demographic.
Yeah.
Like, how much behind the scenes does that become a conscious plan? Like, and did the demographics of a fan base ever like take you by surprise?
I mean, It's not like some kind of evil plan behind the scenes where you're like...
It wouldn't be an evil plan.
But you know what I mean? Where it's like, ah, I'm going to target the gays and I'm going to get their money. It's not like that. It's kind of... You definitely have to be realistic about who your fan base is and play to your strengths. That's the same with any industry. You know, you always want to play to your number one strength. So, you know, if your fan base is a gay fan base, then for sure, then you want to play to that.
Yeah.
So it's there's definitely discussions that go on about whether what you're doing is relevant to an LGBT audience, or those discussions definitely happen, and about keeping your audience happy. There's no point in alienating the people that love your music. I think that's when artists can make a really big mistake, is when they completely forget who loves your music, who's your supporters, who are you, and you do something that's so alien to them that it's just like you've lost them.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's definitely, those conversations do take place for sure.
And you know, a lot of those artists, like, they might not be LGBT themselves, but spend a lot of time in kind of gay bars, like everything from like performing at the Pride circuit to like GAY and Porn Idol. And do you ever kind of talk about how to approach that?
Well, yeah, definitely, because obviously I've got a lot of experience of living and breathing those things. So I definitely would give people an opinion on how it is best to approach things. But I think with a lot of the artists that I work with, they've got a real natural feeling for that anyway. You know, I really didn't have to start working with Dani Minogue and explain to her. Right, this is GAY.
Like Jade Thirlwall. Here's how you behave in a gay club.
I know, exactly. I think it has to be authentic. And I think that's something that an LGBT audience can sniff at immediately when someone is, you know, what do we call it? Gay baiting.
Yeah.
I think we can sniff it out from a million miles away. And so there does have to be a real level of being authentic, shall we say, there. So whilst obviously you can give advice on what the best things to do are, and, you know, not to overexpose yourself or things like that, but you definitely have to have a natural support there.
Do you think, so slightly left field one, but I was thinking about kind of the experience of like, being gay, having been in the closet, obviously it means you're good at keeping a secret. Do you think that's useful training for becoming a celebrity publicist?
What, keeping secrets?
Like, yeah. I mean, you must have some serious...
I mean, I never really thought about that ever, to be honest. That's a really interesting question.
I have to give credit. Yeah. This is my husband's question.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, it is a really interesting question. And I guess... You know, I don't want to, like, it's kind of, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that I'm a good liar.
No.
Maybe I am.
But more, but like, what I'm saying knowing is, when you reveal things and to certain people, and...
Yeah, I guess so. I've never really thought about that. I guess the thing about it is it's called almost like when you say in the closet, it's like, I'm not sure I ever really was in the closet in that sense. I mean, I definitely didn't speak about being gay when I was at school because I was already like totally bullied. So it was kind of like, I wouldn't have brought that into the surface because it would have been hell for me. But I think it was pretty obvious. So I don't think I didn't ever say I wasn't, shall we say.
Right.
So I never pretended to be straight. Yeah. I never had girlfriends. I was just living my existence, and it was obvious. So I don't think I was ever particularly keeping anything particularly secret myself. But I think I am good at keeping secrets. I have to be good at keeping secrets because
the stakes are
the
quite
secrets
high.
That I know are pretty high.
Yeah.
I always say that if I was ever going to write a book, there should be some very nervous people around about what I
just
would
imagining the legal
be dropping. But I think on a similar tip to that, what being gay and being in that position as a kid where you feel isolated and names are thrown at you every day, and you know you just don't have anyone to talk to or any common ground with anyone, it does give you a really thick skin. And I think that's really important as a celebrity publicist. I think that's kind of probably more what I learned from being gay as a kid, was to have a really thick skin and to just not let things affect me too much, and to just, it's a bit like Jinx Monsoon.
Water
off a duck's back. That definitely has helped me, because in this industry, there's so many things sometimes where, you know, you're just taking a punch and a punch and a punch and a punch, and you can't let it get to you personally. You have to have a really thick skin. And some people in this industry can be vile. You know, a lot of journalists that I've dealt with over the year have not been the nicest people in the world to deal with, shall I say. And, you know, you can very much be stabbed in the back in this industry. And I think that having a thick skin is really important. And I think that's what being gay as a kid, you know, gave me.
And
for sure.
Is that something that you try and pass on to your clients as well?
Yeah, all the time. It's like, one thing I always say to them is, will you be worried about this in 5 years' time? Because when they're stressing and they're upset and they're on the front page of the newspaper about something, and it's really like, it feels massive in that moment, and it's like, will you be upset about this in 5 years' time and still talking about it? And they're like, sometimes they're like, no, you're right. And I'm like, so that's fine. It will be gone. It will be over. Forget about it.
What is your most kind of treasured memory of your life, like working with all these amazing women and icons?
I mean, I couldn't give you one memory.
You were on the like Nietzsche Cola Tino.
Well, I was
going to
say that because that's the funniest thing is that I've done so many things over like 20 years. And the one thing that always keeps coming back all the time is that people are like, you were on the set of Machico Latina. And it's like, yeah, I was. And it's really weird because obviously when Jerry left Spice Girls and we took her on and we were doing her PR, we obviously knew it was a massive moment. I mean, it was a massive pop culture moment. And we knew we were in the thick of the storm. And then I remember going on the Machico video because it was after Look At Me had come out, and then we were filming the next single. And I remember thinking, oh my God, this is so amazing and so much fun, and I was loving it. But looking back on it now, I didn't really realise how iconic it was at that point to so many people. Like, I think I didn't really realise like how big the Spice Girls were to people. Because you've got to remember that I wasn't a kid with the Spice Girls. I was working. So whilst I loved them and could obviously see how massive it was, it isn't until I speak to the people that are sort of 10 years younger than me and I see, oh my God, like my boyfriend, Rich, is obsessed with the Spice Girls, and he's just like, oh my God, you don't understand what it was. And I'm like, I do get it now. And so now I understand why people are like, oh my God, you were on the Bag It Up video. You were on It's Raining Men. I went to all those videos, but it was just like getting on with the job. But now you look back on it and you realise, I realised how iconic those times were. you know, Jerry was an amazing person to work with, like just so much fun and so much energy and so many ideas, and you know, really understood who her fan base was and really understood how to play to it, you know, all those amazing GAY performances, you know, getting on a horse and running down Old Compton Street while I'm trying to tack the sign with the single onto the horse.
And like, <Wouldn't you? laughs>
it's like, hang on, the sign's not straight. And like, you know, there's so many things that now, obviously, especially gay guys say to me, oh my God, I can't believe you did that. And I remember that moment and I was obsessed with when she went on the horse down Old Compton Street. And like, you know, again, you're just working and you don't realise that these moments are so iconic in people's lives. Yeah. And then you look back on it and think, wow, I've done like a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that because when I worked with Jerry, it was kind of one of the first really big pop things I did that, it's obviously like a pivotal client that I work with in my life, because it was kind of the first time I'd had, I guess, a number one record and, you know, worked with someone that was, you know,
at the absolute
in, certainly in the UK, it was like everyone was obsessed with Jerry at that point. It was like proper like madness. So yeah, that was a fun time for sure.
Yeah. Jerry is just endlessly fascinating because, like, if you look at her now as well, compared to like in the 90s, and she's doing this all white thing,
yeah,
which I can't quite figure out, but I love it.
I mean, I don't think anyone seems to be able to figure that out. But I think the thing, not in a shady way, by the way, just like, you're doing your thing. But I think that's always been what Jerry's done. She's always had a thing.
A thing.
So
and
it's
this
kind of
is
that's
the
why
thing.
She's so clever. Is, you know, there's always been. I don't want to say gimmick, because gimmick lessens it in a way. That's almost like making what she does less. Yeah. I don't know what the word is.
It's eras, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like she's always got something going on. And I think that's what she's so smart at pulling out of the bag. But, you know, just going back to what your original question was, you know, that it's really hard to think about just like one thing. You know, when we're talking about the amazing women that I've worked with over years, you know, there's been so many people that have done inspirational things, you know, working with the girls Little Mix, like, you know, bringing it bang up to date. I mean, how could you not be inspired by those four girls and what they've achieved and everything they stand for? I mean, you just I'm sometimes in awe of what they do. They're amazing.
I was just thinking, actually, like you saying right at the start about Madonna and those album inserts about HIV and AIDS.
Yeah.
Every time I've been to see Little Mix, Jade has taken a moment to speak to the audience about LGBT rights.
Yeah.
And given how young that audience is, I just, every time I'm like, this is amazing. This is how you use your platform.
Yeah.
And yeah, obviously they have a big LGBT fan base, but also they have loads of kids who look up to them, and to hear that message is like,
it's amazing,
so important.
And I'm with you on the fact that every time I hear it, I feel emotional about it, and I see the reaction in the crowd, because I feel like a pop band maybe wouldn't have done that.
Yeah, no,
like
sort of no one asked her to do that.
No.
And it's just because it's so personal to her that she's,
it's
doing
really
that.
Genuine. It's totally genuine, and it's not something that she is kind of fabricating or faking. You know, when she moved into London to be in the band, she's the first one to admit that she felt a bit alienated, and, you know, it was her gay friends that took her out and, like, you know, took her to clubs and took her to bars and got her out of the house. And, you know, because she moved to London, like all the girls
did.
I mean, two of them were sort of from outside London, but they moved into London, and obviously they didn't have friends here and stuff. And I feel that Jade's like, oh, my gay friends totally like adopted me, and she feels like she's giving something back by doing it, and it's something that she totally believes in. So you can't help but feel inspired by that. And obviously I love that personally, because there's someone within the band that really is championing something that I believe in. And so it's amazing to amplify that and work with that. And, you know, I've been to Jade, you know, to Stonewall events and marched in Manchester Pride with her. And, you know, we're always thinking about things that we can do to help the community, for sure. It's definitely something that we talk about a lot. and something that she's really passionate about.
Yeah.
The other girls are, you know, equally supportive, by the way.
Yeah,
it's not
of course.
Just Jade sitting there on her own.
Yeah, yeah.
The other three absolutely as yeah. well. But, you know, Jade's definitely the one that, that has championed it.
And final question that I ask everyone, who else do you think I should speak to, either as a Dorothy or a friend of Dorothy?
I mean, obviously you should do Jade.
Yes, the dream.
Which we're already talking about. Yeah. So, yeah, you should definitely speak to Jade. I don't know who else you should do. Who else would be interesting?
I mean, like, so much of your list. Like, someone like Emma Bunton's really interesting.
Yeah,
as well.
Any of the Spice Girls would
any
be really interesting.
Yeah.
Because they've lived it.
Yeah.
Danny,
or we were talking
Danny
about,
would be amazing.
She would. Yeah, I'd love to talk to her. Or someone like we were talking yesterday, weren't we, about Talisa.
Yeah.
Because she's had such a journey.
Yeah.
And again, it goes back to who takes her seriously and who's mocking her. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Talisa story is a whole, is a whole nother saga that, you know, we could spend ages talking about and maybe for another time. But like, you know, that was certainly an extremely eye-opening, time for me to be working in, and to watch the way that she as a woman was treated by the media and treated by the public to a certain extent as well. You know, here's a girl that comes up from, by her own admission, the streets of Camden. You know, her and her two bandmates put music together, spend their whole teenage years writing and recording music that they put out, and then become massively successful, become multi-platinum artists, selling out the O2, and she gets this amazing opportunity to go on a TV show and be a judge because they're looking for a hot new talent to come on board.
Yeah.
And she, from day one, you just got the feeling that people were gonna bring her down.
You know, I'm still mad, actually, about the way the media treated Talisa and the impact that has on the way that she's remembered and seen by the general public. I'd love to get her side of the story. Next week, we're taking a short break, so there'll be no new episode, but we will be back on Thursday, the 13th of February. Until then, please keep tweeting me at Dorothy_podcast. I'd love to know what you thought of our first friend of Dorothy and who I should speak to next. See you soon.